Exploring the importance of having the right skills to succeed, this is Skillfully Speaking, supported by Babcock International, presented by Skills Ambassador Jackie Grubb.
Welcome to Skillfully Speaking. I'm your host, Jackie Grubb, and today I'm joined by Dame Ruth Carney. She is the first ever chair of Babcock International Group and has had an impressive career in industry, spanning some 37 years. She was made a Dame in this year's New Year's Honours list and continues to be an inspiration to so many. Welcome, Dame Ruth.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And it's lovely to talk to you. And I'm going to go straight into the first question because I'm so excited to get as much wisdom and motivation out of you as possible. So you've had a very distinguished career in industry. Where did it all start for you?
Well, I guess the start is I was the second of four children, quite a down-to-earth family. So my father was an accountant, but started right from scratch as an article clerk. Mother was a teacher. No one in the family had ever been to university. But I think we had very strong values as a family, strong, stable, and it was all about humility, looking out for other people, and doing the right thing, really, sort of strong family values and a real focus on success. So achievement was really celebrated, whatever it was. I had a very good education at a girls' school, broad education. So I remember, interestingly, the school elected not to put us in for, in those days, O-levels in things like geography and history, because they didn't want to be constrained by the narrow curriculum and wanted to expose us to much broader learning. I had a brilliant physics teacher, which was an important part of where it all started. And so after school, I went off to Bristol University to study maths and physics. And I guess if I think about peers of mine in senior roles in industry now, that would not be that untypical, nothing unusual. What happened next was very unusual. So I did my degree in Bristol. I went to Cambridge and did a master's in advanced maths. And from that, I managed to get a research grant to do research in general relativity.
Wow, what's general relativity?
General relativity, yeah. Like black holes.
Right, okay.
And I did that for a while. You know, I wanted to be an academic.
Yes.
And I did that for a while and then realised that although that had been what I wanted to do for a long time, actually it was too esoteric and not relatable to lots of people that I decided to leave that. And I applied to various organisations to still do research, but to do something much more practical. So I went from academia into Shell, starting in a research centre outside Chester, and actually spent about 12 years there. So the first third of my executive career was actually as a researcher, which is very, very unusual for somebody who then gets to senior roles in business. And it was only after that time that I really sort of launched a campaign to get myself a move out of the research side and into the business side of Shell. And then I got more onto a normal track, I guess.
Well, during your career, you've also demonstrated a real strong commitment to diversity. How important is that to you, and particularly when it comes to women in business?
Well, I suppose in many ways, diversity has just been part of my whole career because, being honest, in the early days, it was really about me and people like me getting the opportunities to progress and pursue a proper career. So in that research centre where I started in those days, there were very, very, very few women in graduate roles and very few women really pursuing a career and progression. And, you know, that was in the days of feminism and very much focused on getting a fair crack at pursuing different opportunities. So it was about self-interest originally. And then I went through the phase that diversity became a thing and in particularly related to women. And I was then the guinea pig in sort of early experiments to test if women could actually do male jobs.
Oh my goodness.
So, you know, it's just been with me forever.
Yeah.
But having said that, I would say looking back now and thinking why it's so important to me now, and actually that thinking has really changed completely because I now think of it really as the whole fight for talent in organisations, which we work closely on lots and lots of skills and talent issues. But it's very difficult to find and attract all the staff that we need to be successful as a business. And we need to be attractive to anyone, you know, whatever their background, their experiences, whatever diverse characteristics they have. We want anyone who has the right attitude and aptitude to work with us. So we really need to focus on becoming known to them, making ourselves attractive. But then when we bring people in, making sure that they can flourish in the organization and that they feel valued. So that's a really strong business rationale and driver for thinking it's critical. The other thing is, and this is very much what I look for now in all the organizations, all the groups that I work in, I've had so much experience where having people with really different experiences and backgrounds and perspectives working together, they make it so much less vulnerable to groupthink. Because I've so often heard somebody who, from a different perspective, will just ask a question or make a comment that makes everybody stop in their tracks and think, ah, hang on, we hadn't thought of that. And therefore, the conversation goes in a different direction. And that just makes the decisions that come through eventually much more strong and sort of resilient and robust to the real situation as opposed to the narrower situation that people have been looking at.
Yeah. I'm so interested in teams and putting teams together with different brains. And, you know, there's not just diversity, is there? There's cognitive diversity. Yeah. And creating a safe space for people to flourish and people to have a view. And like you say, then ideas come forward that some other people might not even think about. So do you really feel like the world is a different place now to when you started? And if so, what is different and what is there still to do? And I'm intrigued of the questions that you were asked about what it's like for a successful woman in those days to be not the same as a man, but can you unpick that a little bit as well?
Well, yes. So I would say what's changed, and I'm going to talk about women in particular.
Yeah.
So first of all, I think lots of aspects that were just uncharted territory. Yeah. When I was coming out of research into business, you know, they've become much more normalized now and less remarkable. And just coming to your final question there. So I remember quite vividly about 30 years ago, I worked in Shell in Germany, and I was the most senior woman ever to work in Shell in Germany. And that meant I went to some meetings of the senior group, which had never had a woman with them. So they even had to go through the question to me, because it was in German, of was I going to attend every time? Was I going to attend? Because the person, the chairman, wanted to know whether he needed to start his introduction with liebe Herren, dear men, or liebe Dame, liebe Herren, dear lady and gentleman.
Wow.
So that was quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
But also, I recall from some of those meetings, sitting at a table with a group of men, senior leaders, and realizing it was probably the first time ever that many of them had sat across a table from a woman expressing her views on the business issues that we were discussing. So it was just so unusual and so remarkable then. And I think now, you know, we've got women in the role chairing companies like me and a growing number of them. We've got women as CEOs of companies, although that's growing very slowly and there's still a lot more to be done before we really see breakthrough there. But lots of women in senior roles and getting to the stage where it doesn't have to be commented on.
No. Exactly.
You know, it's no longer the first woman in the room. And so I think it's becoming more normalized.
Yeah.
So I think that's all really positive progress, really. In terms of what more needs to be done, I still think it feels very fragile. So in most organizations that I'm involved with, where there's a woman in a senior role, the pipeline of talent behind, it's a struggle to get plenty of women and any diversity into that pipeline. So there's still a lot more needed to get women and other diverse talent coming through the talent pipeline to really make this sustainable going forwards. And the other thing I come across a lot is organizations that are driving inclusion and diversity, but they don't seem to really embrace that business imperative. So you get the feeling that it's more they're doing it because they have to do it. It's part of the governance code. It's one of the things they have to disclose and report on. But it's not really embedded into the business strategy and the business priorities in the way that I think it should be. And maybe, therefore, organizations that are doing an awful lot of things, but it feels very much like initiativitis, and they haven't really figured out what's important for them, what are the key blockers and issues that they have to tackle, and therefore, what are the most relevant interventions that they could be making. So I think they could actually just be a lot more strategic and smarter about how they go about it.
Yeah, God, it's really interesting, isn't it? So still lots of work to do, progress being made. And I think especially with diversity, but with lots of things, it's not about giving something lip service and ticking boxes. It's actually getting right underneath it with purpose and having impact on things that are going to make a difference in the world, isn't it?
And above all, understanding why.
Yeah.
This question, why is this important?
Yeah, a really important subject. So moving on to Babcock International Group, can you tell us more about your role?
Okay, so maybe I need to talk a bit about what a board does.
Yes.
So my role is chair of the board of directors. That is a non-executive role, so it's not a full-time role. I'm not a sort of full-time employee of Babcock, and I do have some other roles alongside Babcock. The board consists of a majority by law of independent non-executive directors. So this is back to what you were saying, pulling a team together of people with very different skills and experiences and styles and other aspects of diversity so that we have a team that can really have a robust and varied and rich conversation about key issues that we need to consider. And then on the board also, as sort of fully equal members of the board, we have in Babcock's case two executives, which are the chief executive officer and the chief financial officer. Some boards have more than two executive directors. And my simple rule of thumb for how it works is that the CEO runs the business and the chair runs the board. Yeah. And the board has a number of key responsibilities. So the board, with the executive directors and the executive, work on and sign off and agree what is the strategy for the company. The board then oversees performance. So it oversees the financial performance, also the progress that's being made on key strategic priorities and any other aspect of delivery that is important. The board oversees governance. So it ensures that everything is being done in the right way, and in particular that all the regulations and requirements that are laid out are being adhered to. It has a role on culture. So boards are expected to articulate what culture they require in order to deliver the strategy. And then the board wants to see, where are we compared with where we want the culture to be? What are we doing about it? And how do we know? And what is the evidence for how we're really doing there? And then the final thing is that the board appoints the senior executive directors.
Yeah. That really articulated well the board responsibility and then the executive responsibility. And it was really clear and really succinct.
Good.
So thank you for that.
I've always been very honest with people. And especially when I'm talking to the early careers, for example, in Babcock, I'm going to explain what a board does because most of my executive life, I didn't know.
Yeah.
So it's not something that you just pick up.
And the relationship I have with my chair of governors is exactly like that. And we're really clear and really have open dialogue about that. So also, you're credited with delivering growth at Babcock in a relatively short period in your time span there. So economic growth, growth of businesses is really important to so many people in lots of different aspects of life and jobs and work. So how do you approach steering organisations through periods of transformation?
Well, first of all, I'm going to come back to what I just said, which is that the CEO runs the business.
Yeah.
And so the executive team runs the business. So you said I'm credited with, but I would say they take the lion's share of the credit because they are the people who do all the heavy lifting in driving change. So I guess the first thing is to make sure that you've got the right people in the organisation to embrace and drive the change you think is needed. I think from all my experience of transformation and change, first imperative is being really clear on what needs to change and why. And then it's something you need to be able to articulate it in a way which is clear and simple and relatable to all the people in the organisation. Because, you know, if you've got something which may be completely correct, but it looks terribly complex and abstract, you're not going to get people actually changing how they do things and how they behave. So I think it's really important to think about that sort of attraction of a better future and what is going to be the sort of guiding light that everybody can identify with.
And the same message to different audience that might perceive it differently. And skillfully speaking is all about skills. Mm. So the information and the discussion that we've shared so far, you've obviously got a huge amount of wisdom and skills. So can you tell us about the skills that you have and actually what's been key into you achieving what you've achieved?
Mm. Well, I think first, I definitely have, from my background as a scientist, I'm good analytically. I'm good at synthesizing. I'm good at sense making and sort of being able to cut through complexity.
Mm.
So I think quite often I can really cut to the chase and identify these are the critical things here, and therefore this is what should drive our priorities. So I think that's a key skill that I have. I think I'm good on wood and trees. Meaning, I often think that organizations obsess with strategy and wanting to, have we got the right strategy? Have we got the right strategy? But actually, the most important thing is then to implement your strategy, to make happen the things that you want to happen.
Yeah.
So that ability to just keep on, are we getting traction? Are we delivering what we've set out to deliver? I can keep up that focus. But at the same time, I like standing back, and I can stand back and look out and see the bigger picture, and so look strategically at the context and use that to think about, but are we still on track? And are there things that we should be adjusting because of the environment changing around us? So I think that sort of being able to
do both. That's a skill within itself, isn't it? A real skill in itself. Yeah.
And then I think back to your previous question, I've had a lot of experience on leading change, a lot of that from different executive roles in Shell. And I think I was very fortunate that that started actually at a stage where I was part of an organization that was really looking into adopting a different approach to change, because we'd done so many sort of big top-down programmatic change programs and recognized that you very rarely got real sustainable material change. You know, it was just a lot of effort, but things at ground level didn't really shift. And we had some experts supporting that organization on the theory behind why instead actually doing what's called emergent change is much more effective. And that's where you create a clear sense of direction, you set some clear rules about how the change is going to happen, but it's very much about empowering leaders to own that change and to drive it, and then holding them accountable to do that. And recognizing that that might mean that you have to provide them with some support because they might have aspects of it that they're not confident in. But it's so much more effective when you get the change coming from the organization rather than trying to push it all from the top. And from having a lot of experience, and by the way, through that whole process, having got to know a person who is a real expert. She's researched, she's written books on effective change leadership, and she's become and is today a very close personal friend. So we spend quite a lot of time talking about this.
Yeah, good conversation.
Sort of specialist subject.
Yeah.
So that's important. And then I think back to this team, I think I have the ability to bring together very strong teams with very different backgrounds, diversity of all kinds, as we discussed. That can really be more than the sum of the parts. So a team where there's a strong collegiate sense, a lot of openness and trust, but also the ability to have really divergent conversations, robust conversations, have disagreement, and do all of that without losing that trust and staying friends afterwards.
And that brings the values into things, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I think keeping by your values keeps those even difficult conversations really focused.
If you want to build on your skills and get yourself on the right path to success, visit the City College Plymouth website, cityplym.ac.uk. You can hook up with courses, download information packs, guides, and much more. Or find us on social media. We're Skillfully Speaking Podcast on Instagram and Skillfully Speaking on Facebook and LinkedIn. Skillfully Speaking, where hidden skills are revealed. Now back to the conversation.
On the subject of leadership, gosh, the world, isn't it now? Our planet is an ever-changing place. What advice would you give to aspiring leaders, especially women who want to break into traditionally male-dominated industries like defence or energy?
Well, I would say, just by the way, as you say, defence. So just a reminder that the three major UK defence contractors are at the moment all chaired by women. So my first piece of advice would be don't create self-imposed barriers.
Yeah, beautiful.
I think that very often people just put constraints in their own mind on what they can and can't do. And I think it's really important not to do that. I think my advice is always, whatever role you're doing, whatever job you have, do a really good job. Do your best. Be a really good team player. But always be looking for what can I do to go above and beyond the job. What else could I be doing that could add more value to the organization? And in those ways, to stand out a bit more, to get known, to get recognition, to demonstrate a bit of what you can bring. And I think everyone can do that. And my only caveat is, but don't be creepy about it. Because you mustn't overdo it.
Yeah.
But I think everyone can find those ways where they just show a bit of what they can do.
Yeah, I love that.
And then I think at any stage, always be thinking not just about the job you're doing, but what might a next step be? Look a little bit further ahead. Are there roles you see around you that you might like? And so be looking to the future, looking at creating those options and opportunities for yourself. But at the same time, I think it's really not helpful to think that you need a multi-year detailed plan of how your career is going to progress. Because I think in practice, being open to totally unexpected things that come along and taking those is the way to really unlock a lot of richness and variety in what you do. And certainly a lot of the key steps that I've taken have come totally out of left field. You know, just
you
things I was asked
them
to do, and I said, okay, I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
And that's given me a lot of different experiences, which I think are incredibly valuable now, because they're things I can draw on to think about how to think about current situations.
Yeah. And that's why you've held so many senior roles, because you have. You've held senior roles in major global organisations. What have been some of the biggest challenges that you faced, and how did you navigate through them? Because we all learn, don't we, through those challenges.
Well, I would say probably the toughest thing I've been through in terms of me being very senior and having to manage it is actually the transformation at Babcock. But in particular, the part of that, because the company is operating very well and growing now. But when I came in, the story was about resetting the company. And one of the things we needed to do was to restate the accounts. So early in the tenure of the new chief executive and chief financial officer, they commissioned a very detailed review of the balance sheet and the contract accounts. And we concluded that we needed to make a significant set of adjustments. And this is really serious, you know, when you've published your accounts and then you need to restate them. So it needed to be done very, very carefully by all of us. So we needed to really be clear that we got to the bottom of it and really understood what we were dealing with. At each stage of the review, as things became apparent and were discovered, we needed to really assess, well, what does this mean in terms of where are we? Do we have any disclosure requirements under different regulations? And the board needed to really understand where we were at and how this was being navigated. So the important thing was to be very open so that everybody really understood and was well informed about where we were at, but critically not to jump to conclusions. So as the chair, I needed to sort of hold the situation where there were still a lot of unknowns and we needed to see the whole thing through. And of course, there were anxieties. There was a wish to get clarity quickly, but it was actually really important to just be calm and say, take the time that was needed to do the thorough job that we had to complete.
That's really
so that was an extraordinary experience. Yeah. And then as another example, I would just remember, it's not that long ago, COVID. So COVID was a huge challenge for everybody and for organisations in different ways. But in particular, during COVID, I was on the board of Associated British Foods, which owns lots of different businesses. It owns Primark.
Okay.
But it also owns lots of food production businesses.
Yeah.
So when COVID hit, Primark had to close all its stores within a couple of weeks. At the same time, we had to find ways to make it safe for staff to keep working in the food factories because, you know, the food was still needed. We needed to keep the nation eating.
Mm.
So, you know, huge, huge challenges on both sides. In Primark, in particular, the executive had to figure out how physically to close stores, how to close them safely, what you do with all the staff, you know, with the whole furlough rules, but different in every country, and so hugely complex. What to do about the supplies? So we literally had containers on their way across the ocean, full of garments with no stores. And then we had all the garments that were being made in factories.
Yeah.
And so how to deal with suppliers and support them financially. And then for the company, you know, you suddenly go from 100% of revenue to zero revenue in like a couple of weeks. And the impact of that on cash and potential liquidity. How frequently should the board be meeting? Do you need to change the cadence? And one of the things that was really valuable, and I learned this, was the value for the non-executives talking to their peers and friends in all different organizations to hear about lots of challenges that might be relevant for us and then be able to bring those to the board so that we didn't miss anything. We didn't sort of have any blocks about what could be real problems down the road for us. So it was a fascinating time.
And creating a voice for everybody and how they were feeling or what was going on at different lines. I mean, as an educationist, we have to keep open. And actually, just listening to that, I feel really grateful. And in terms of the apprentices at Babcock, we had to keep all of that going.
Yeah, we had to still maintain the summary.
Yeah, exactly, for obvious reasons. But actually then, reflecting on the retail industry and the supply chain and all what you've just mentioned, you know, that's a pretty huge job at the same time, wasn't it? So, Dame Ruth, being named in the New Year's Honour List is a significant recognition, isn't it? So what did that moment actually mean for you personally? And then what did it mean for you professionally?
Being made a Dame.
Dame,
oh,
wow.
My goodness.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely thrilling and so humbling.
Yeah.
I mean, the first thing I thought was, oh, my goodness, why me? And you look down the list and think, oh, gosh, I don't deserve to be here. So that's very natural, I think. I loved it in part because I think it was such a affirmation of all the work that those executive people have done in Babcock, because the citation talked about the turnaround in Babcock. So I think that was great for the team. And I've had to do a lot of talking to myself to balance the huge part of me that wants to just say, oh, goodness, don't make a fuss about it. Yeah, don't make a big deal. I don't want to blow my own trumpet. But on the other hand, recognize that this does have significance for other people, like in Babcock. Also, because the citation said for services to industry. So a woman being made a Dame for services to industry, a huge number of women have been in touch. And even people I hardly know, just to say how exciting and important that is. Just a couple of weeks ago, I went back to my old school to talk to the sixth form.
Oh, how lovely. Where was that?
In Sutton in Surrey.
Oh, amazing.
And, you know, so I think it has mileage in terms of making people feel aspirational. What could they do?
Yeah. So a plethora of things, really, isn't there? So in terms of the organisations that you work with or work for, and then obviously people love stories, don't they, and storytelling. So actually going back to your school days and those people, you know, looking at somebody and thinking, I can be like them also. So there does feel like there is a responsibility that does come with that recognition,
yes.
Dame Ruth. So perhaps in mentoring future leaders or using your platform to drive changes in areas that you're passionate about. You're already doing that, but is there something else that you'd like to do with all of that?
I think not specifically because of the honour, because I think it just adds to the sense of wanting to give back that has already been very, very strong with me for many years. And, you know, for me, that's recognising back to the beginning of this conversation. I think I was very, very lucky in terms of having a great and really strong family, great education, loads of opportunities that have come my way. So I'm very much driven to see how can I use all of that, because I've now got opportunities based on the positions that I have, the network that I have, and the capabilities that I have to make a difference in some small way. So I think of that partly through the roles that I have. So for example, with Babcock, and I'm on the board of BT, how can I, through being involved with them, help them to be really successful and effective, given that they are really important organisations for the country.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, that's part of seeing what I can do to make a difference. We've talked about diversity and inclusion. I often will speak out, be involved in initiatives to support more progress on diversity and inclusion. I also am involved with looking at ways through business to get more traction on climate change. So I'm a supporting chair of Chapter Zero, which is an organisation that's looking to support boards in driving more traction through the executives and down through the business of companies. I think for the country, actually. So I'm really passionate that we ought to be doing much better, harnessing the power of business together with government to drive change, to drive economic success. So I've joined the board of the CBI for that purpose. I've also been very much involved in some initiatives to look at corporate governance and stewardship in the UK to just make sure that we aren't inadvertently handicapping businesses where they should be much more vibrant in really driving economic progress. So I've already got lots of things that I'm doing. And I think the damehood adds a bit to maybe convening power or strength of voice. I mean, these are just the things I feel strongly about, and I'll carry on working on them.
Yeah. I think there's a podcast too. I'm really passionate about the things that you've just said. And I think in terms of the economy and us getting even better at strategy and, you know, working through boards and working through organisations, there is another podcast in the making of what you've just said. And I'm really, really interested in that. And actually, on top of that, you're also, or you were, the chair of Powerful Women until 2022. And this sort of showcases women in the energy sector.
Yes.
And we've already touched on there are chairs already, but just keeping the focus on women and women aspiring and realising their own aspirations. So can you tell us more about what they do and what your role was there?
So Powerful Women, as you've said, it's an initiative. I think it was launched in 2014. And its aim is to be a catalyst, really, to get more women into senior roles in the energy sector in the UK. And the energy sector is another sector that was coming from a very low pace. I took over and got involved with them about a year after the initiative was launched.
Mm.
And what they'd done was they'd got massive enthusiasm and support. And they hadn't started to tackle the question of, so what are we going to do? So I think my role was really to translate all of that ambition and energy into what are the things that we can do that will really make the difference and move the needle. First thing I would mention then is measuring and reporting, so getting data. So there were no proper stats on what is the status in energy. So we did a lot of work to get some regular reporting, and that then holds up the mirror to organisations. We've reported sometimes in general terms for the sector, but then also eventually naming the companies. And, you know, that gets attention. We thought hard about this question of who really needs to own this change. And it was clear that it was the big companies, meaning the biggest employers, who needed to make the difference. So we formed something called the Energy Leaders Coalition with the CEOs of some of those leading companies. And that has actually gone from strength to strength. More and more of the top companies in the UK have got involved. And really interesting, because it's been a grouping of people who have not come to that to show off how well they're doing, but they've really shared where they're not getting traction and where they're stuck.
Yeah.
And so they're sort of owning the journey together, which I think has been brilliant. Powerful Women organises events, so gets women together, stimulating events, which energises and motivates them and also helps them to build their networks and get themselves much more visible. And it's commissions reviews and research on different aspects. So, for example, about 3 years ago now, they commissioned an excellent piece of work on the lived experience of women in middle management roles in energy. And there were some real insights, like the line manager lottery being so critical in determining how your career progressed. And then progress. So, in fact, the measure that has been most used is the representation of women on the boards of those top about 80 companies. And it's gone from 9%, shockingly, in 2015 to, I think it's 29% last year. So they are getting there. The sector is moving. But I think, as we discussed before, an awful lot to be done to get that pipeline much stronger than it is today.
Yeah, because leadership can be every role through an organisation.
Yes.
And that transition from the ground into middle leadership is so complex, isn't it? So it is about supporting leaders to prepare them for the future, to realise their aspirations, but to help.
Yes.
All times of their career, really. So sort of changing the subject totally, I am passionate about health and well-being, and I feel it's a guiding principle that needs to thread through the fabric of everything we do, whether it's personal or professionally. And I'm proud in my own organisation that we put health and well-being at the top of every agenda and don't give it lip service. Mm. You know, we've got real impact and traction in terms of supporting people. So how do you manage your own health and well-being? Especially in such a demanding leadership role?
Well, I think basics, really. Yeah. So I've been pretty diligent about exercise for years and years and years. Currently, I go to the gym regularly. I do Pilates classes. I walk a lot whenever I can. I love walking in the mountains. So a couple of weeks ago, we were in Switzerland for a long weekend. And I just find that so reinvigorating, just mentally and physically. Although physically, it's a bit exhausting.
Well, it is, isn't it? Because when you're tired and then you think exercise, because you're obviously having to put more energy into it, but it is so, so important.
Yeah.
So getting out in nature is really important to you.
Yes. Yeah. And then I think I eat reasonably sensibly. We're very good. My husband, bless him, does all the cooking.
Okay.
I mean, it's all scratch cooking. Everything is fresh.
Yeah.
And lots of veg, lots of salads and fish probably every night except one in a week. I am an active grandmother.
Oh,
so Mondays are grandmother day.
Oh, lovely.
So that work-life
balance.
That is a marvellous balance.
Because,
I mean, it doesn't always feel like work-life balance because quite often people are trying to call me, but you just can't. You know, you just say, no, it doesn't work. So I think that's really helpful. Beyond that, I try very hard not to take myself very seriously. When things are difficult, just try to laugh them off and just have that perspective of, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen because of this? And just think about the more important things in life.
Yep. So your family, the healthy eating, getting outside in nature, the exercise. A picture of health sitting opposite me today.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Dame Ruth, it's been just an absolute pleasure to talk to you. for a plethora of reasons, from leadership to health and well-being, to, you know, get through those challenges, to advocate what we're passionate about. So it's been so lovely to talk to you.
Really
Thank
enjoyed
you so,
it.
So much.
Thank you.
Skillfully Speaking is supported by Babcock International. Visit babcockinternational.com. Presented by Jackie Grubb. Produced by Paul Philpott. Production support by Lisa Hartwell. Edited and mixed by Martin Burgess Moon. Video content by Mark Stevenson. Coordinated by Louise Greenleaf. Produced by Fresh Air Studios. Copyright City College Plymouth. All rights reserved.